Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is April 13th. And we're going to finish up census, maybe move on to the next chapter today. Sign-in sheet is going around, so make sure you sign in. And don't forget, on Monday, which is when we usually have our next class, it's spring break for teachers. So you're welcome to come to class, but there won't be class. So maybe y'all will just stay home, too, and apply yourselves to this material, which is probably a good idea because right after spring break you have lab practicum 4, and then the week after we have exam number 4. Now let's pay attention to that on the schedule, because I have something wrong on the schedule. Heart is not chapter 18, it is chapter 19. All right, so on the schedule for April 11th and 13th, okay, wow, we're really far behind. I didn't realize that. That's chapter 19, okay? So cross off that 18 and put a 19 there. And then on exam 4, cross off 18 and put 19. Heart will be on the next exam. Okay, so make sure you know that. And I don't think blood vessels won't be on the fourth exam. It will be on the fifth exam. Okay. No, you want to, I don't want to talk about exam 5 just yet. Let's just get to exam 4 in spring break, and then when we come back, what is going to be on exam 5 will be blood vessels, lymphatic, and the rest of those chapters. Those other chapters are pretty small. Yeah. So 18? No, the heart is 19. The heart is 19. Yeah. So, yeah, so the ordering of these chapters is a little off. I just want to make sure I get you going for the correct four chapters for exam number 4. Yeah. Central nervous system, because you've already had a test on fundamentals of the nervous system, like the different kinds of neurons. Yeah, so you're tested up to chapter 12. So it's going to be 13 central nervous system, 14 peripheral, 15 autonomic nervous system, 16 special senses and heart, which is 19, okay? And we're covering heart in lab pretty extensively, so I could probably get through heart in just one lecture here, in lecture, yeah. Practicum 4. Yeah, whatever in unit 4 in the lab manual is for practicum 4, which includes those blood vessels. The only thing that is being deleted from practicum 4 is fetal circulation. Okay, because I need to go over that in lecture just a little bit. Okay, so we were talking about the ear last time. And the ear has got 3 different senses associated with it. And the senses that we're talking about, are they special senses or general senses? Yeah, what is a special sense? Yeah, special senses, you don't have receptors all over your body. You have them in one or two locations, and it's a sophisticated organ with a lot of development, so we call that a special sense, as opposed to a general sense that you have receptors all over your body. Give me an example of some general senses. Touch, vibration, what else? Pressure, yeah? What else? I'll give you a hint. How about an ice cube? Temperature, yeah, you can feel temperature all over your body. And then there's a strange one that sounds like it's a special sense, but it's not, and that is proprioception, right? But you have proprioceptors all over your body and every muscle, every tendon, so it is a general sense, not a special sense. All right, so the special senses of the ear, there are 3 that are associated with this inner part of the ear. We call this the labyrinth. Hearing, which is due to this thing that looks like a snail. We call that the cochlea. There is a sense of linear acceleration that's due to the vestibule, which is this part of the labyrinth right here. And then angular acceleration or spinning, which we get from these semicircular canals. Those are the 3 parts of the labyrinth, and those are the 3 senses. So we could call this hearing, we could call linear acceleration static equilibrium, and we can call linear acceleration kinetic equilibrium. equilibrium in a spinning kind of motion. All right, so I think maybe I talked about this last time, but maybe not completely, but the ear has three major parts. It's got the external ear, right, from the pinna over to the tympanic membrane, and then the middle ear from the tympanic membrane over to this membrane, which is the entrance to the labyrinth. And what is the shape of this membrane right here? It's oval, so we call that the oval window. It's right underneath one bone that carries vibrations from the tympanic membrane into the labyrinth. This is the stapes, okay? Then the malleus and incus right here. So these bones vibrate carrying sound pressure waves into the watery environment inside the inner ear. And it takes a little amplification to do that because sound really does not all by itself like to go under, to go into water or go underwater. All right, so if we were to have a big pool in here and I could submerge your head in the pool and I kept talking, you could hardly hear my voice because sound just doesn't like to go into water very easily. So this is a device that matches that sound up so it can go into the middle ear. All right, so these bones are in the inner ear. Oh, we talked about this pharyngotympanic tube, I think, last time. It's a way to equalize pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane so that it can vibrate above and below atmospheric pressure. If the pressure in the middle ear is too high, it's going to push the tympanic membrane all the way out as far as it can go, and then it can't vibrate. And if it can't vibrate, then nothing, right? Okay, so it's got to be equalized, and you do that by chewing gum or sneezing or swallowing when you're in an airplane or driving up around in the mountains. All right, so those are the major parts of the ear. Okay, and those were the auditory ossicles that we talked about. There are some muscles in the middle ear right here that can contract and dampen the vibrations. I don't see them on this slide right here, but can dampen the vibrations of the auditory ossicles. Here it is right here. Like the tensor tympani muscle and the stapedius muscle. So probably you can recall starting your car first thing in the morning when it's really nice and quiet outside and you're not driving anywhere so there's no road noise. And what do you notice about the stereo in your car or the radio? It's blasting like crazy, right? And I do that to my car, and then I think, well, gee whiz, maybe it was one of my nephews that borrowed my car last night, was listening to really loud music, and I can't imagine that he's not deaf. But guess what? I probably did that too, because as you hear loud sounds, these muscles contract and lower the volume, protecting your ear, and then what do? You just reach out and crank the volume up a little bit higher, okay? But you got to be concerned, because that can damage your ear, right, if you listen to music that's too loud. Okay, so you do have some muscles in there that do adjust sound levels. Okay, so let's talk about the senses for hearing in particular. And that sense for hearing comes from this part of the bony labyrinth that we call the cochlea. It looks like a snail. And there is a membranous labyrinth on the inside of this thing. And actually, the way you should think of the cochlea is as a piano. Because what can you do with a piano? It has keys, and if you hit keys on one side of the piano, you get, let's just say, high frequencies. And when you hit keys on the other side of the piano, what do you get? Low frequencies, right? And the same thing for this thing, too. It will have a tendency to vibrate at high frequencies in this region right here, but low frequencies in this region over here. And it's really a piano that has what? It has been rolled up so that it fits inside the temporis region of the petrous region of the temporal bone. All right, so that's just the way evolution has taken something that's really long and wrapped it up so it fits in your ear very nicely. All right, so that's what we call the cochlea. And there's a duct on the inside of it called the cochlear duct. All right, so how does sound energy get into the cochlea? Well, the tympanic membrane vibrates, which vibrates the auditory ossicles, which vibrates the stapes on that oval window, and sound pressure then enters the cochlea for you to hear. So that's how that happens. And if we were just to make a cut or a cross-section through the cochlea, we would see that it has a number of different chambers in it right here. These chambers, the top and bottom chamber, have perilymph in them, This inner chamber has endolymph, so this is that fluid environment. This chamber right here is connected to the oval window, and this chamber down here is connected to another window, which is what we call the round window. Let's see if we can go back. Can almost see it here. Here is the round window. That's how sound enters. And if all that energy, sound energy, can enter the cochlea, but it has nowhere to go, then it's going to damage the cochlea, and it could even break some of the bony labyrinth as well. So that sound energy is released by vibrating a membrane right here, which we call the round window. So sound goes in at the oval, and it leaves via the round window right here. So let's look at the internal structures. So it enters through this. This is what's connected to the oval window. This chamber is connected to the round window. So this chamber right here is called the scala. This one here is the scala tympani. This is connected to the round window. Here is the cochlear duct. Sometimes we call that the scala media. All right, so let's now zoom into this region right here, because this is the organ that allows us to hear. These two canals just transfer sound energy to vibrate this region right here. All right, so we zoomed right in. This top one's connected to the oval window. That's the scala vestibuli. This is the one that's connected to the round window. So sound comes in this chamber right here, and then it exits, so it has to go across this organ, which is called the organ of Corti, to leave your ear, right, within the cochlear duct. Sometimes we call that the scala media. All right, and then there are nerves that take this nerve impulses to the brain. So this is part of the vestibulocochlear nerve. It's a cranial nerve. So let's look at this region right in here. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so now we're zoomed way into the scala media, and this is the organ of Corti. The organ of Corti has got probably three main parts to it. It's got the tectorial membrane that vibrates when sound passes over it, so it vibrates up and down. And then this part down here, okay, we just call this the basilar membrane or basal membrane. It's pretty stable. Right, so the tectorial membrane vibrates by itself, but it's connected to the third component, which we call hair cells. Right, now what would you need to see these hair cells right here? Can you see these with your naked eye? Absolutely not. They're microscopic. And these cilia that are projecting off the apical surface right here, right, are very small. You need a good microscope to see them. So they are what we call stereocilia, and when people first saw them, they called them, well, little hairs sticking off of these cells, so that's why they call these hair cells. When sound moves across the tectorial membrane, it vibrates, and it's connected to these cilia, and it bends the stereocilia. That starts electrical activity in these cells right here, which are the receptor cells for hearing. So that's a pretty popular type exam question. What is the receptor cell for hearing? You're going to say it's a, are you kidding me? A hair cell? And you're going to say, well, I'm not kidding you. That's exactly what it's called. Okay? It's a hair cell because it has these like little hairs sticking off of them, which starts nerve impulses going to the brain from just this part of the cochlea, okay, which corresponds to a particular frequency. This is going to go to part of the temporal lobe. That's where the primary auditory cortex is for hearing, right? And you have corresponding pianos in the temporal lobe. So when an inner part of the temporal lobe receives impulses, you hear a high frequencies. When a more lateral part receives electrical impulses, you have the perception of a low frequency. All right, so it just maps out just like the organ of Corti does. All right, so I want you to know this tectorial membrane, basilar membrane, and these hair cells, which are the receptor cells for hearing. And here's just a nice electron micrograph where you can actually see the receptor cells for hearing. So here is a cochlea. What has happened to this cochlea? It's been unrolled, right? So it kind of looks more like a piano. These parts of the cochlea here vibrate at low frequencies. These are the parts that vibrate at high frequencies. And when the organ of Corti vibrates, it allows sound to go from the scala vestibuli into the scala tympani and then out the round window. right? So this is basically just like a piano that's all rolled up inside your temporal bone. Okay, so that is the first sense for hearing. And let's see if I missed anything on that. Not really. Let me just look at a bunch of other figures right here. That's not bad. Okay, so I guess that's all I'm going to say about that, except that here is the temporal lobe, and you can see nerves reaching the temporal lobe from the thalamus. The thalamus is always a relay station for sensory signals, telling it to go to the temporal lobe. So here is the primary auditory cortex. Here is the lateral sulcus separating the parietal from the temporal lobe. And when this region receives impulses, you hear low frequencies. When this one receives electrical impulses, you hear like mid-range tones. And when this area receives electrical impulses, you have the perception of high frequencies. So again, it's what? It's a range just like keys on a piano right there. And so this comes from one particular part of the cochlea. And these nerves that go out over here come from an area, a different part of the cochlea, namely closest to the oval window. All right, so that is for hearing. Let's go to another sense. And the sense I want to talk about next is balance. So here are the two senses for balance. You got static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Equilibrium is just a way that you can maintain balance. Static equilibrium results from structures inside the vestibule, which we call the maculae. So where is that at? Here's a good example. So here is the bony labyrinth. Now, what part of the ear is the bony labyrinth in? Is it the outer ear, the middle ear, or inner ear? It's the inner ear. So here is the cochlea. Inside the cochlea, you have the organ of Corti, which is the organ for hearing. But what's the receptor cell for hearing that's part of the organ of Corti? It's those hair cells, right? Okay, that I poked fun at you with last time, but indeed they're hair cells. All right, here is the vestibule, which is the center part of the labyrinth. And here are two sense organs for linear acceleration. And linear acceleration is what we call static equilibrium. Both of these are maculae. And there are two of them. One is called the utricle, the other is called the saccule, and they both look like this structure right here. So the utricle and saccule are the organs for static equilibrium. What's the organ for hearing called once again? Organ of Corti. Okay? So here is a macula. It's either going to be the saccule or utricle. And here is a little basement membrane. And here we have an epithelium with cells with stereo cilia poking off of them. So guess what they look like? They look like hair cells, right? So these are just hair cells. And these stereo cilia poke up into a little gelatinous mass right here. And that gelatinous mass is affected by acceleration like gravity. Gravity can pull on it. The effect of gravity pulling on this gelatinous mass is enhanced because there are weights situated on top of it. And these little weights right here are what we call otoliths. Odo, when you hear odo, what should you think of when you hear odo? Ear. And lith just means stone. So here are little stones. Actually, they're crystals of calcium carbonate, which are embedded in this gelatinous mass. So what gravity is pulling straight down, it's not bending the stereo cilia, but if you were to bend your head forward, so now the gelatinous mass is perpendicular to gravity, right? It's going to sag and it's going to bend the stereo cilia, and you'll have an idea of what position your head is in. And that's depicted with this slide right here. Right, so here you see the hair cells embedded in this epithelial layer, the gelatinous mass or the otolith membrane on top are the otoliths. And when you change the position of your head, this little, it's almost like vitreous humor in the eye, except it's a little bit stiffer than that. It causes these stereo cilia to bend, and your brain interprets that as a change in body position. Or if you bend your head backwards, what happens to these hair cells? These stereo cilia bend the opposite way, and your mind then knows, your brain knows, now your head has turned in the opposite direction. Okay, so this is important for body position, so you can tell if you're standing straight up or lying down flat in the bed, even with your eyes closed, because of the utricle and saccule, the organs, right, that are stimulating these hair cells, which then send electrical impulses to the brain. All right, so that is for static equilibrium. The last sense in the ear is kinetic equilibrium. And probably you should write down in your notes, what is kinetic equilibrium sensing? We said for static equilibrium it is linear acceleration. What about kinetic equilibrium? It is for angular acceleration. Oh, you know I do have it in there. Another way of saying that is what? Spinning or twisting. Right, so angular acceleration for kinetic equilibrium. Let's look at that. All right, so there's a bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium, and those are the semicircular canals right here. We talked about the cochlea already. What's the cochlea responsible for? Hearing. The vestibule is responsible for static equilibrium or linear acceleration, and the semicircular canals are for kinetic equilibrium or angular acceleration. All right, so how many semicircular canals do you see right here? I see one, I see two, I see three. Okay, and these represent the three planes that define our space, right? Like how many planes did we have for imaging, for viewing the body? We had three. We had sagittal, we had transverse, and what's another one, the last one? Coronal. Right, so coronal, or we could call that the frontal plane. These semicircular canals have endolymph in them, which is a fluid, which can flow through these semicircular canals around and around in a circle. That's where the spinning part comes from. Right? So the bony labyrinth right here is what we call, the semicircular canals are the bony labyrinth. The semicircular canals, the membrane inside, right, makes up the membranous labyrinth. And notice there's a little bulge at the base of each of these semicircular canals. And that bulge reminded somebody of a little glass vial. And sometimes a little glass vial is called an ampule. Right? Sometimes maybe if you're going to get a shot, they have some kind of serum in a little glass vial and they snap the top off and then they aspirate it out of that. That's called a little ampule. So that reminded somebody of an ampule here. And there is an organ inside of it, okay, that we call the crista ampullaris, named after this little bulge in the semicircular canal. So the crista ampullaris is the organ for angular acceleration. So this cupula is like a little gelatinous mass, similar to what we had in the maculae. And here is the epithelium that has, oh, look what it has in there. It has cells with stereocilia poking off of them, and these are receptor cells, and so these are hair cells once again. Okay, and when this cupula or gelatinous mass bends one way or the other, it bends the stereocilia, and your body gets a sense of spinning in one direction or another. Right? If they bend forward, you get a sense of spinning one direction. If they bend back the other way, you get a sense of spinning in the other direction. And the semicircular canals are pretty fascinating because it can tell exactly how you're spinning in space, right? If you're spinning around right to left or head over heels, okay, because it has all three planes associated with it. So how on earth are we going to get a picture of why that works? Okay. Let's look at this diagram right here. Okay, so here we have endolymph in a semicircular canal. And remember, it's a circle, so it can flow around in a circle. And any kind of mass, well, this probably will work. I forgot I was going to do this demonstration. Any kind of mass has a physical property called inertia. So what the heck is inertia? Does anybody know what a definition of inertia is? It just says that a body in motion will have a tendency to stay in motion. It won't want to stop. Okay, it's going to eventually slow down if you're on like planet Earth because there's frictional losses, but if you're in outer space and your mass and you're moving, then you're just going to move forever, in that one direction because mass has that property of inertia. Another property of inertia says that if a body is stationary, guess what? It does not like to move. It likes to stay there, right? Okay, so maybe over spring break, Easter's coming up, you're going to have a bunch of family come over, right? And have a big dinner that afternoon, so you're going to have like wine glasses and candlesticks, right, and all kinds of plates on the table. And you might want to demonstrate the property of inertia for your family, something that you learned in anatomy class. So here are all the plates and candles and wine glasses you have on the table. And what can you do? What can you tell me? I got to make sure this is closed in case it doesn't work, okay? What can you say about all those wine glasses and stuff? Because of inertia, they want to stay there, okay? But the tablecloth, what can you do with a tablecloth? Because these things have inertia, you can pull the tablecloth out from underneath all those wine glasses and nothing will spill. So that will be a really nice demonstration, okay? Like Easter afternoon, especially everybody watching. That's really good. So a body that's stationary likes to stay stationary, right? Okay, now what was the other corollary to that? A body in motion wants to stay moving. So if we start out slowly so it doesn't slip off, okay, if we start out slow, we get this moving and then stop suddenly, what happens to the Coke bottle? It likes to keep moving, right? So that's another property of inertia. All right, so let's relate that to the semicircular canal. So if you're standing stationary right here, then this endolymph is stationary. It's not moving, right? And then all of a sudden you start spinning. This part of your body that has the crista ampullaris is connected to what? The temporal bone. So as soon as the temporal bone moves, the crista ampullaris starts to move because it's connected to your body. But what about that endolymph? What does it like to do? It likes to stay put. It doesn't want to move. And there's nothing that's pushing it, right? So the cupula is moving, but the endolymph is stationary. That's just like what? Fluid flowing over the cupula right here. So these hair cells bend in this backward direction. And now let's just say that you spin for a long period of time, like about a minute. What happens to this endolymph? It starts to spin with you, right? Just like that Coke bottle. It starts to move, right? So now it's moving at the same speed as you're spinning around. And then all of a sudden you stop suddenly. Your crista ampullaris stops. But what about the endolymph? It's still moving. And it can move in a nice, right, circular pattern right here, and it bends the stereocilia back the other way. And when you open your eyes, what does it look like? It looks like even though you're stationary, the crista ampullaris is telling your brain that you're spinning because the endolymph is still flowing over the crista ampullaris, and it looks like you're spinning the opposite direction. Okay. So the semicircular canals are important for kinetic equilibrium, right, which is what? Angular acceleration. And acceleration means a change in the velocity, the change in spinning. If you spin at a constant rate, then the ampullaris won't tell you information. But when you start or stop, that's when it will send information to your brain. Because stopping and starting is what we call acceleration. If you're spinning at a constant speed, that's not acceleration, and the crista ampullaris won't be able to tell you anything. Same thing for static equilibrium. It's based on acceleration, a linear acceleration right and left or up and down, but it's what? A change in velocity that matters, not a constant velocity. All right, so those are the three senses of the inner ear. So let me take a look at this slide right here. My cursor. This is a nice diagram. So here is the labyrinth. What part of the ear is the labyrinth located in? Inner ear, right? And this bony part of the labyrinth right here is called the cochlea. This bony part is called the vestibule. And these bony parts right here are the semicircular canals. Okay, what's the organ in the cochlea? And what sense does it give you? The organ of Corti, and it's the sense of? Hearing. And what's the receptor cell? A hair cell. All right. What's the organ? Oh, I tell you what. Here's the vestibule. That's the bony labyrinth. What's the organ in here? For Yeah, the utricle and saccule, at what sense do they provide for you? Static equilibrium, that is linear acceleration. And what's the receptor cell? That's right. I'm going to say you're kidding me, but you're right again. Okay. And here is the bony labyrinth. Right? What do we call this bony labyrinth here with these three circles? Semicircular canals. Okay, what's the organ for that's associated with the bony labyrinth, semicircular canals? The crista ampullaris. And what sense do the crista ampullaris give you? Kinetic equilibrium or angular acceleration or spinning or twisting. And what's the receptor cell that's used? It's a hair cell. Okay, so all three of these senses use the same receptor cell, but is hearing anything like equilibrium senses to your mind? Not at all, right? One is vibration, the other is a totally different kind of modality of energy, but it's those exact same kinds of cells that have been adapted to sense those different energies, those different modalities of energy. That's kind of interesting, I think. Okay, so that's it for the senses chapter. And don't forget, what kind of sense is kinetic equilibrium? Is it general or special? It's a special sense. Yeah. Okay, not a general sense. Okay, so just look at your exam figures to know which figures are really important, but some figures that I really like. Here's a really good figure. Okay, so here is a cross-section of the cochlea, so you can see the scale of vestibuli. That's how sound enters. What's the tube that sound leaves the cochlea in? That's the scala tympani. That's connected to the round window. Scala vestibuli is connected to the oval window. And then the cochlear duct or scala media contains the organ of Corti, and the important parts of the organ of Corti is the tectorial membrane, right? This basal membrane and these hair cells right here. Okay. So those are good things to know about. Okay. What is next? Is heart next? Oh, well, there's one group, one section hasn't gotten a lecture on heart yet. Is it heart? Yeah, indeed it is. Okay, chapter 19. Okay. So let's find chapter 19. Look at some figures right here. Okay. The size, shape, and location and important landmarks of the heart. Your heart is about as big as your fist. And your heart is mostly in the, it is in the mediastinum, which is what, mostly right in midline, mid-sagittal line of your body. But you all know that it is not really right smack in the center of your body. It's mostly where? Over to the left, right? It's mostly in your left side of your thoracic cavity. All right, when we look at a heart, for instance, let's look at this picture of a heart right here. You could think of it as a triangle. Here is the tip of a triangle down here. The top of a triangle or a pyramid is called the apex. And what a pyramid is sitting on is the base. So here would be the base of a triangle. So the heart you could think of as an upside down pyramid or triangle. All right, so here is apex and here is base. When it's situated in your body, okay, here is the, let's pretend here is the apex of your heart and the base is up over here. It's not strictly in the center like that. As you go from base to apex, it's angled over to the left. So the base is right smack in the center. The apex is over on the left. That's why most of the heart is on the left side of your body. But the heart is doubly angulated. Not only does it deviate to the left as you go from base to apex, it also moves anteriorly like this. So the apex of the heart is actually touching the chest wall right underneath your pectoralis muscle. And when it beats, it actually flops up against the chest wall like that and beats up against the chest. And you can feel that with your fingertips. You can palpate where the apex of the heart is actually pounding your chest wall. And that's called the point of maximal impulse, or commonly called PMI. So if you want to find out in particular where anybody's heart is exactly, you can just feel right underneath the pectoralis muscle if you have their permission to do that, right? All right, so don't forget, it's a biaxial tilt because why? It's the heart is angulated to the left, but also anteriorly as you go from base to apex. Another important landmark on the heart is this anterior longitudinal sulcus. So what the heck is a sulcus? What's a sulcus? It's a depression. Yeah, another name would be groove, right? So it's a depression, but not really a fossa. It's long and narrow. So here is a sulcus, and in the different sulci of the heart, it's usually filled with adipose tissue and blood vessels that fill in the depression. So you get really good contrast of that white or yellow adipose compared to the red dark color of the myocardial muscle itself. So here is what we call the anterior longitudinal sulcus. And notice that it's on a diagonal. It doesn't go straight from base to apex, right? It's not perpendicular from the base down to the apex. It kind of wraps around the heart like a candy cane stripe or a barbershop stripe on the surface of the heart. Another name for the anterior longitudinal sulcus is the anterior interventricular sulcus. So it goes by either name. Both are very nice descriptive terms for this sulcus. All right, so those are the three most important landmarks on the heart to get you started, because the apex is going to be what? Superior or inferior? Right or left or what? It's going to be inferior, and the base is going to be superior. So now you know which is the superior one. The only thing you need to know now is which is the right side, left side, or which is the anterior and which is the posterior side of the heart to know how it fits in your body exactly. Well, here is a really nice landmark, this interventricular sulcus or longitudinal sulcus. What side of the heart is that on? It is on, was it left or right? Or what? I'll give you a clue. It's part of the name. It's on the anterior side. Yeah, so it's on the anterior side. So if this is anterior, okay, that's like looking at my heart just as I'm standing here. All right, so this right here represents this side of my body. What hand is this? That's my left hand. So here's the left side of the heart. All right, here is the right side. So now you have positioned this heart exactly so that you know inferior, superior, anterior, left and right. And then what's going to be on the back side? That's the posterior side of the heart. Okay. One thing that we cover in lab is that the heart is a pump. It's pumping blood, and it has to have chambers in order to pump blood. So one question I ask is, how many chambers does the heart have? It's got four chambers, right? And I think I'll show you some pictures. The chambers of the heart. Let's look at those. Okay, really good. Here's a good exam figure. All right, so here is the apex. Here's the base. I see that it has two large chambers that are inferior, here and here, and two chambers that are superior. The superior chambers are called atria. The inferior chambers are called ventricles. All right, and the heart has two sides to it, a left and a right. So here would be the left ventricle. Over here is the right ventricle. Here is the right atrium, and then over here is the left atrium. And whenever you separate a chamber, like the nasal cavity, when you separate your nasal cavity into like two different nostrils, what is that tissue separating your nostrils? That's a septum. So here is a septum separating out the ventricle. So here is the interventricular septum. And there's a septum that separates the atria. That is the interatrial septum. These are nice solid walls. Blood shouldn't be going back and forth between these chambers at all. Okay, so those are the four chambers on the heart. Blood is going to flow through the heart in one direction. It should never flow backwards. So blood is going to flow from an atrium into a ventricle. On the right side of the heart, it's going to flow from an atrium to a ventricle on the left side of the heart. And it should never flow from a ventricle back into an atrium, no matter what side of the heart it is. So there's a structure that prevents that backward flow of blood, which we call retrograde flow. And does anybody have an idea of what kind of structure prevents retrograde flow? It's a valve. It allows flow in one direction, but not the other. And I see two valves right here and right here. These are valves between an atrium and a ventricle, so they're called atrioventricular valves. This one here is an atrioventricular on the right side. Here's atrioventricular on the left side of the heart. Okay, so a good little quiz for you is to say, to ask you, how many chambers does a heart have? Four, right? How many valves does a heart have? I see two right here, but actually I see more. It is still four. So four chambers and four valves. So that makes it easy to remember. There are two atrioventricular valves, and there are two semilunar valves. I see one right here, and I see another one right here. So one, two, three, four. So how many chambers? And how many valves? Four. All right, so you know the names of the chambers. Let's look at the names of the valves in particular. These atrioventricular valves are made of some fairly pliant and soft tissue right here. This is what we call a valve cusp or a valve leaflet. Okay, and on the right side of the heart, there happen to be three of these flaps. So the one on the right side of the heart is called the tricuspid valve. The one on the left side only has two flaps, a little bit different. And so we call that the bicuspid valve. So how on earth are you going to remember that tricuspid is over here on the right side and the bicuspid is over here on the left? Because before you buy a car, what are you going to do? Yeah, you're going to try before you buy, right? So that will help you remember tricuspid and bicuspid. But the tricuspid and bicuspid are still both atrioventricular valves. The bicuspid valve also goes by another name. Depends on who you're talking to. Might be more familiar to call it by the other name because it reminded somebody of a hat that people wear. Like when the Pope goes out, celebrates big things, right? Goes on tour. He wears this funny hat that has a point on the top of it. It folds flat, but when he puts it on his head, it kind of puffs up like that, and it's called a mitre. And so when people first started doing dissections, it reminded people of the Pope with his hat or cardinals with their fancy red hats on, right? And so they called it the mitral valve because it looks just like that hat. So bicuspid is exactly the same thing as tricuspid, but what kind of valve is that, bicuspid or mitral valve? What kind of valve is it? Yeah, the bicuspid or mitral valve is what kind of valve in the heart? It's an atrioventricular valve, right? And in particular, the mitral or bicuspid valve is what? A atrioventricular valve on the left side of the heart. What is the atrioventricular valve on the right side of the heart? Tricuspid valve. Oh, that sounds like a good lecture exam question to ask you, okay? So that would be the tricuspid valve. So here's a good exam figure to help you memorize all the structures inside the heart. All right. The other kinds of valves are between ventricles and blood vessels that are taking blood away from the heart. And those vessels that take blood away from the heart are always called arteries. And I see one artery that's colored blue and another one that's colored red right here. This artery that's taking blood away from the right ventricle is called the pulmonary trunk, or you could call it pulmonary artery, right here. And when the heart pumps blood into the pulmonary artery, when the heart relaxes, it will like to flow back into the heart. But that will kill the person if that happens. So guess what's between the pulmonary artery and the right ventricle? Another valve that prevents that retrograde flow of blood, and that is what we call a semilunar valve. Notice that it has a much different shape compared to the atrioventricular valves. It has three little bags right here, or cusps, that inflate when blood tries to go backwards, and then that prevents a backward flow of blood. Since this is the pulmonary artery, this is called the pulmonary semilunar valve. A second major artery taking blood away from the heart comes from the left ventricle. Left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, and I see that valve right here, right at the root of the aorta, so this is called the aortic semilunar valve. All right, so now you know all four valves, and notice they kind of lie within a plane, right at the base of the heart. Even though they're all kind of pointed in different directions, they all lie in this plane right here. All right, so that's some important things about the heart. The other thing is that we should know the layers of the heart. The superficial layer, right on the surface of the heart, is what we call the epicardium. The layer that makes up the muscle tissue of the heart, that's called the myocardium. And then there is a very thin layer, thin as the epicardium over here, that lines every internal surface of the heart. It's really thin and it's slippery. That's called the endocardium. And it's slippery because, remember, blood is a connective tissue that's a fluid. It's got to flow over all of these nooks and crannies inside the heart without causing blood clots. And since the endocardium is smooth and slippery, blood can slide right over it. Right? That is the endocardium. So you got epicardium, myocardium, and endocardium. Furthermore, these valves right here, all these valves are made from one layer of the heart. Which one would you guess? Epicardium? That would be a bad guess, because that's way on the outside of the heart. Myocardium? When you look at a heart, you won't find any muscle in these valves at all. So myocardium is not a good guess either. It is made from endocardium. And that's good because that means these valves are smooth and slippery as well, if they're a healthy valve, which allows blood to flow over them without clotting, which is what you want. Because what could happen if you generate a clot here in the heart? What could happen? It could go to the brain and cause a stroke. It could actually end up in the heart and cause a heart attack. Or if it goes to the lungs, it can plug part of a lung up, and that's what we call a pulmonary embolism. Some people live through some of those episodes, and some people don't. Probably more don't. And you don't want a pulmonary embolism because that part of the lung is going to die, right? If it's plugging up a part of the blood vessel to the heart, that part of the heart is going to die. Or if it plugs up a blood vessel going to the brain, that part of the brain that blood vessel feeds is going to die. And you don't want any part of your body dying, right? That's not good. Okay, so those are the main layers. The heart is beating very strongly inside your chest. Okay, and it's not connected to any bones. And so the way that it is connected to the rest of your body is by the pericardium, right? The heart, it sits inside the pericardial cavity. And the pericardium is outlined by this membrane that we call the pericardial membrane. And it has a number of different divisions, just like the meninges does. It has a strong division and a weaker division, a weaker layer. Okay, so let's look at the different layers of this membrane that surround the heart. Okay, so here we have, you know what, I do want to go back to this, right? The layer, this is a membrane. Now, you learned two general kinds of membranes back a number of weeks ago. There was something called a mucous membrane and something called a serous membrane. What's the definition of a mucous membrane? It lines a cavity that's what? A mucous membrane lines a cavity that is open to the outside world. Like your oral cavity is a mucous membrane because your oral cavity is open to the outside world. Nasal cavity, mucous membrane. Okay, you don't know what the urethra is yet, but that's part of your urinary tract. That's open to the outside world. That's a mucous membrane too. Okay, now here's a membrane that surrounds the heart. Is this area around the heart open to the outside world? Hopefully not, right? So it can't be a mucous membrane. It has to be a serous membrane. And remember, a serous membrane has how many parts to it? It's got three parts. It's got three divisions. It's got a parietal part that's lining the cavity that organ sits in, and then a visceral part that's right on the surface of the organ, and then there is a space between the parietal and visceral part that's filled with fluid. We call that the serous cavity. And on the heart, we call that the pericardial cavity filled with pericardial fluid. All right, so we're going to zoom into that area right here. So here is the heart, and let's zoom into this region right here and look at those different membranes that are around the heart. So here is the heart chamber itself, and here is that first membrane that lines the inside of the heart. Here's a layer. It's also a membrane that is the endocardium. Here is the layer that's made up of myocytes. We call that the myocardium. And then right on the surface of the heart, what did we call that? That was the epicardium. Right, that is the epicardium. Okay, that's when you think about these different structures here as layers of the heart wall. Okay, but don't forget, these help form a serous membrane. The epicardium goes over to a blood vessel and it folds back, and now this becomes part of the parietal pericardium, which is normally up against what? The body wall. So this is up against the pericardial cavity. And the epicardium is the same thing as the visceral pericardium because it's touching what? It's actually touching the heart. So the visceral pericardium touches the heart. The parietal pericardium is the more superficial one. It's not touching the heart. And what do you have between the parietal pericardium and visceral pericardium? You have this serous cavity right here filled with serous fluid, but since this is the heart, we call that the pericardial cavity filled with pericardial fluid, right? All right, and since the heart needs some support, there is an additional fibrous layer. This is almost like the dura mater right here. We call this the fibrous pericardium. It's just the most superficial layer of the parietal pericardium right here. So I know that's a little confusing, but if you hear epi, myo, and endocardium, think of layers that make up the heart. But if you think of parietal and visceral, think of what? The serous membrane that is holding the heart in position. So your viewpoint probably should change a little bit. And between them is the pericardial fluid in the pericardial cavity. Okay, what do you call an infection? Maybe I mentioned this in that first chapter. What do you call an infection or an inflammation of the pericardial space right here? That's pericarditis, right? And that's a pretty serious situation. I see the pericardial space right here. In a normal heart, it's about 1 centimeter. But if there's an infection or inflammation of this space, it gets a lot thicker. It gets to be 2 or 3 or even 4 centimeters thick, right? Just filled with fluid. All right, so let's think, what's the job of the heart? What's the job of the heart to do? The most important job of the heart is to pump blood, right? So these chambers right here have to contract, right? And the heart certainly will contract. And in order for it to pump blood, blood has to actually enter these chambers. So if the heart contracts and there's no blood in the chambers, then it's not pumping blood, even though the heart is contracting. And what do you really want? You want blood being pumped. You don't want your heart just to sit there and beat. You want blood to be pumped through your whole body. So blood has to enter the chambers. So if you have pericarditis and this pericardial space starts to fill with fluid, guess what? The ventricles get compressed. They can't fill with blood because now there is fluid in this space right here. And when the heart contracts, it's not pumping any blood. Okay, so pericarditis is very serious. That needs to be resolved very quickly so that the ventricles can fill up. So when the ventricles contract, they're actually pumping blood, not just working out, not just for fun exercise, right? So a good way of doing that is just with a hypodermic needle. Insert a hypodermic needle into that pericardial space and aspirate that fluid out. And then all of a sudden the heart can fill up normally. And it's amazing. A patient will feel wonderful right after that. Though they might not want a video of it. Okay, or watch it happening. Okay, because that fluid has to be withdrawn. Okay, so we talked about the chambers of the heart, talked about the valves of the heart. So you got to know which ones are atrioventricular and which ones are semilunar. And what's the function of a valve? To prevent retrograde flow. What's the function of a chamber? Is to pump blood. Okay. Okay, we talked about these transmural layers right here. Ah, but we didn't talk about blood flow through the heart yet. Right? All right, so the heart is not like an electric motor or an electric pump that continuously pumps blood all the time. Sometimes the heart is pumping and sometimes the heart is not. Okay, and that's because the heart has two phases. It has a contraction phase and it has a relaxation phase. And when does blood get pumped? When the heart contracts or when it relaxes? When it contracts, okay? That's when blood gets pumped. We call that systole. So systole is one phase of the heart cycle, all right? But we also just said that in order for the heart to pump blood during systole, there has to be diastole, and what happens during diastole? That's when blood fills the ventricles up so that when the heart does contract during systole, it can actually pump something, right? So these two phases are very important. For a long time, people were only interested in systole because that's when blood is pumped, but now people are really interested in the diastolic function of the heart too, because there is no systolic function unless the heart can fill with blood. So that's another important heart phase that everybody is interested. So systole corresponds with contraction. That's the highest pressures that happen in the heart when it contracts. And diastole is when the heart relaxes, and that's when the pressure actually goes to zero inside the heart. So as a matter of fact, when you get your blood pressure taken, how many numbers do you get? You get two numbers. And the reason is because sometimes your heart is contracting, pressure is really high, at other times your heart is relaxing, and your blood pressure starts to decline when that happens. So you get two numbers, right? The first number is your systolic pressure. That's always the biggest number, like 120. And then you get a number like 80, that's the diastolic pressure. That's the lowest blood pressure in your arteries. And it doesn't go any lower than that, because what happens right after diastole? The heart pumps again and your blood pressure goes up to 120. So your blood pressure in your arteries close to the heart varies between 120 and 80. And then it goes back up to 120 and 80. Right? So that's why you always get two numbers. Now, if you have a number that is like, instead of 120, let's just say it's 170 or 200 for systolic pressure. What do we call that? That is hypertension. And you can imagine that's really dangerous, because with that high pressure, that could just blow open a blood vessel, right? But even if it isn't that high, over periods of time, that high blood pressure will kill the retina inside your eye, will damage your kidneys, and cause all kinds of cardiovascular disease. So hypertension is a very serious condition that people should be really, really serious and take and treat with various kinds of activities. Maybe exercise and diet is the first thing to do, or pharmaceutical agents that reduce your blood pressure after that. Okay, so what the heck is an artery and a vein? We got to get those definitions down. Let's see if this thing works. It works pretty good. Here you have your heart. Good job. Okay, and here is a blood vessel that's taking blood away from the heart. Here you have a blood vessel that is bringing blood to the heart. And that's how we define arteries and veins, just by the direction of blood flow. And it has nothing to do with the quality of the blood itself. It's just the direction. So any kind of blood vessel that's taking blood away from the heart is what? An artery. And any blood vessel that is bringing blood to the heart, all right, so toward heart, that is a vein. That's the only definition you should ever memorize for artery and vein. We're going to look at capillary a little bit later on. All right, so let's look at the first picture in the chapter. Let's go back to the... Well, I didn't even know I could have two of those open at once. I closed something down I didn't want to close down. Okay, let's go back to... Anatomy, Marib. What chapter is this? All right, here's the first quiz. What chapter is this? 19, yeah. Change your syllabus. Don't forget to change your syllabus. Okay. All right, let's look at this picture right here, over on the right-hand side. So here we see, this is a good study review, because how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Two atria, a right atria, left atrium, and two ventricles. Right ventricle, left ventricle, separated by the septa. Okay, and then you can see all four valves, like this valve right here. Oh, what's the name of this valve right here? Tricuspid atrioventricular valve. Here is the bicuspid atrioventricular valve. Here is the aortic semilunar valve, guarding the entrance to the aorta. And here is the pulmonary semilunar valve. All right, so here I see something with arrows pointing away from the heart. One is blue, one is red. That defines the quality of blood in these particular vessels. But what direction is this blue vessel and this red vessel taking blood? away from the heart. So even though it's blue or red, sorry about that, in case we're falling asleep, I'll have to restrict it. I don't want to talk to them anyway. Okay, so what kind of vessel is this? It's taking blood away from the heart. I see blue and red. It's an artery. Okay, the red stands for, here we see down here, here's the key, oxygen-rich blood. All right, it's high in oxygen, low in CO2. And mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP, so that's a very necessary metabolite. But blood in this artery right here is low in oxygen, high in CO2. So you can have an artery that is either high in oxygen or low in oxygen, depending on where it is located in your body. All right, so if you have blood that's low in oxygen, where does it go to get oxygen? Yeah, you inhale air into your lung right here. All right, so this blood is going to the lung to get rid of CO2 and pick up oxygen. All right, but nonetheless, this is an artery because it's leaving the heart. And since anything that has to do with the lungs, we call that pulmonary. Like if you want to see a physician specializing in lungs, lung diseases and treatment, you would see a pulmonologist, right? So this is what we call the pulmonary artery. Here is the pulmonary, what is this, artery or vein? Even though it's red? It is? It's a vein because why? Look at these arrows. It's bringing blood back to the heart. So here is the pulmonary vein, and it just so happens that it is colored red because it's coming back from the lung, so it is high in oxygen, right? So both arteries and veins can either be high in oxygen or high in CO2, all depending on what circulation it belongs to. So this circulation that involves the lungs is what we call the pulmonary circulation. Let's look at one more circulation, starting with the aorta. Is the aorta an artery or a vein? It's red. It is an artery because it's taking blood, how? Away from the heart. So that's an artery, right? And it's going to take it where? Everywhere in your body except your lungs. So since it takes it everywhere in your body, we call this part of the systemic circulation. The job of the systemic circulation is to deliver oxygen to your body. All right, so oxygen leaves, CO2 goes in, and what kind of vessel is this, an artery or a vein? Is that an artery or a vein? You want to look at the arrow. It's going toward the heart. Toward the heart is a vein, but it just so happens that it is low in oxygen because it's part of the systemic circulation. And, there it is, here's my cursor. And it's bringing blood back to the right atrium, right here. These are what we call the vena cava. The inferior one is called the inferior vena cava, or IVC. This superior one is superior vena cava, or sometimes we just call it the SVC. Okay, so this is a particularly good diagram for you to study because it shows you how many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? Four. How many circulations does your body have? I tried to throw you a curveball because it's not four, it's two. And it's two, right? You have pulmonary and systemic, and that's why basically you have a right heart and a left heart. There are two sides to the heart, and they kind of mirror each other. The only thing is that the circulation is opposite when you compare the pulmonary circulation with the systemic circulation. Okay. In lab, you're going to notice, and you see it on this diagram right here, that the left side of the heart is really thick. This is a big, strong muscle, right? When muscles get big and thick, they get stronger. When they're thin, they get weaker. So the left side of the heart is a lot stronger compared to the right side. Why is that? Because the left ventricle has to pump blood a much longer distance all over your body, all the way from the tips of your toes to the top of your head, while the right ventricle only has to pump blood through the lungs, right? The pressures in the aorta here are about 120 over 80, systolic over diastolic. The pressure in the pulmonary is maybe about 25 millimeters of mercury over something in the teens, right? Only about 25%. So the right ventricle hardly has to work at all compared to the left ventricle right here. So it's much thinner as a result. All right, so that's a pretty good introduction for heart. We'll finish up some other things after spring break. Okay? All right, so don't forget the sign-in sheet, please.